and welcome to the second season of Seniors in the Building. We are four friends exploring aspects of aging together. Our conversations run the gamut from humorous to serious to maybe outrageous. We hope to hear from new voices this year as we invite guests into our conversations. Thanks for being with us. Hi, welcome to Seniors in the Building. I'm Signe.
I'm Jack.
I'm Elaine.
And I'm Rick.
Hello. When we reviewed our first season of podcasts, there were a couple of things that we talked about that we wanted to do for our second season of podcasts. One was to have a few guests, and we've already had my mother. And the other was to delve more deeply into some of the topics that we touched on briefly last season. Today, we thought we'd go a little deeper into the topic of hope. Last season, we talked about the things that bring us joy and hope, but today, we are going to talk about what hope means for us and how we live it out in our lives. By hope, we mean that drive within us that keeps us moving forward in our lives as we work through both the joyful and the painful things that we have had come our way. It's the tenacity with which we keep moving forward toward our goals. And it's a big part of being resilience. So what does it mean to have hope as we're aging? How does it manifest itself in our daily lives? And what do we do in those spaces where we might be feeling hopeless? Is our hope changing from when we were younger?
It's a hard question because there's little hopes and there's big hopes.
Yeah.
And they're connected.
They are.
Like I have a million little hopes.
Mm-hmm.
I hope that the Oilers win the Stanley Cup.
Well, that's just wishful thinking.
But or that the Blue
Jays... You can't do much about it.
Or that the Blue Jays win. But that's all connected to big hopes. And the big hopes, I guess they could be big or little, I don't know. For my children, that they not suffer tremendous loss and grievance and grief. That they live a life that is hopeful and relatively happy and content. And then I've got the big, big hopes for humankind generally, that we not be like some speculation. Cosmologists speculate why we haven't contacted any other life form in our universe or in our galaxy. And one of the theses is that they destroyed themselves as their technologies continued, which we might be on the edge of doing.
Hmm.
So my big hope, huge hope, is that human civilization continues and that it evolves beyond pockets of identities that battle against each other. Whether that be politically, ideologically, or whatever, and make peace, as John Lennon said, let there be peace.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess I was just thinking along those lines, that's maybe one of my greater hopes. And, you know, there's that phrase that sometimes is thrown out there that the arc of history moves towards justice. I know that's a bad misquote about it, but somehow as history moves along, even as we become more developed, and even if we run through pockets of deep distress and destruction, we're still moving towards slowly, inexorably, towards, you know, equality, towards a sense where people can live together. Now, maybe that is, some people would say that's just pie in the sky wishful thinking, but I think that's more of a, like you, your expression, a hope that we have for humanity.
Who said that, do you know?
You know, I'd have to look it up, I'm sorry. It just sort of popped into my head. I'm sure it's there somewhere. Yeah.
But how do we do it? How do we live out our hopes day to day? Because, I mean, hoping for world peace and hoping for humankind to move along and grow and learn is one thing, but keeping hope and faith and moving forward in our daily lives is kind of another thing in the face of the things that are happening in the world and the things that are happening in our lives sometimes. Mm-hmm. So how do we do that? What are the components of hope that help us move forward? In my context of the work that I've done around hope, it's hope is a risk. I mean, hope is daring. Hope is courage, is a courageous act sometimes. And continuing to believe that I can get where I want to go and that humanity will get where it needs to go is courageous, mm-hmm. I think. It takes a lot of courage.
Yeah, that's a good point.
To have, for yeah. me sometimes, to have that hope, because I don't want my hopes dashed.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I don't know.
And it waxes and wanes.
Well, sure, depending on our own experiences and
yeah.
what's going on. Yeah. I guess for me, you know, I study history a lot, but it ties in very much with personal family experience during the Second World War, because my parents were refugees, German ethnics, settlers out of Ukraine, and all those things that happened when the Bolsheviks took over and basically collectivized everything, and then when the Nazis came through and relocated them, and then the end of the war. And I guess what fills me with hope is their personal experience, their perseverance to reconnect mm-hmm. with each other when they were separated, mm-hmm. and then also their hope to find a better place to live, which was part of their impulse to move to Canada, emigrate to Canada. But then tied in with that is the idea that over in Europe, where for centuries these various countries were just always, always at war with each other and tearing each other up and destroying each other, since the Second World War, they have created, for better or for worse, a European Union, and have worked hard to make sure that they don't have a repeat. Mm-hmm. And no one says it's 100% successful. But I see those two things tying together, and I guess that fills me with a sense of hope in terms of my personal attitude towards life moving forward, even if when I'm in my 70s, but it also gives me hope for sort of the political, economic sphere, even with all of the stresses we're under now. So.
I think what I hear you saying then is hope is intentionality. It has mm-hmm. an aspect of intentionality to it. There has to be something actively pushing it or searching for it, or, you know, so there has to be activity and intentionality, right? And I hear that in your mother's and father, your parents' stories. I hear it in people who speak about the situations that they were in and how were they intentional about that. Mm-hmm. You know, personal story too. My youngest brother was 10 years old when my folks died, right? And I still, you know, remember, you know, sitting down with them, I think it was at the wake, and saying, you know, it's going to get better. And he said, I don't think so. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, it might not be where it was before, but it will be, because we're going to all do this together.
Yeah.
So there was an intentionality about that, right?
But there was also the expectation that things would get better, and then the intentionality and the courage
yeah.
to work to make it better too.
Right. I think yeah. that's what it is.
And
it's
to do
whole
it
intentionality
together.
And to,
yeah.
and that it has to happen together. It isn't a single thing.
We can't
singly sort of say, you know, we're going to hope for this, or I'm going to hope for this. I think we have to say we are going to hope for this, that there's going to be others on board with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, doesn't it come from a deep commitment inside? Mm-hmm. Because hope, what do you think of this? Hope is always provisional, mm-hmm. humble, provisional and humble.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because we just don't know.
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But it's also courageous.
I, your story is resonating with me, Ling, because I believe that we are all driven to work through our the things that happen to us. And we've talked before about the importance of community in mm-hmm. doing that, and the importance of community around caring for each other and supporting each other through things, and maintaining, you know, if Jack is in a moment of despair, I can maintain my hope in terms of supporting him through it, and vice versa. And so it is, for me, it's very relational.
So intentional, relational, those are already
courageous.
You know, courageous.
Mm-hmm. And always with a component of there will be another day.
Yes.
And it may, and it doesn't have to be the same.
Yeah. My mother's favorite saying was there's always tomorrow.
Always tomorrow.
There's always tomorrow, like whatever didn't work out today. There's always tomorrow.
And I think as we get older, some of that hope doesn't just reside in personal hope for ourselves, but perhaps for our descendants, say children, grandchildren, if we have them, you know, that we may not benefit from all of this striving, working toward a better world, but our hope is that they can experience that, and that they can, and that what we contribute will lead to that, and that they will, and that's part of the larger hope that even moves us looking beyond ourselves and beyond even our own world and our own reality into the future. So I think that's a piece of hope. I think especially as we get older that we feel is mm-hmm. important for us.
I'm thinking about the indigenous trauma, right, that people have experienced in Canada, in terms of their whole understanding about the healing process, that it's the elders who actually say to the younger ones, you know, here's the story of our life, mm-hmm. and our ancestors have done this, this, and this, right? And so they're constantly reminding them that hope existed before and hope's going to exist again. Mm-hmm. And so in some ways that's what the elders are saying, and that it's going to be done collectively. I wish I had all the language of the words that they use, but I think that's...
But it's storytelling. It's telling the stories and remembering, mm-hmm. remembering the stories and remembering where we have come from, just like mm-hmm. you were sharing, Rick, the story of where your family came from. Yeah. And out of that came a great hope. And great change in both personally as in your family and politically on the continent in terms mm-hmm. of the reorganizing that they did. And mm-hmm. and those kinds of examples, I think, are, for me, are things that I look to for continued hope that even in light of what is happening in our world today, there are still things that we can look to that give us hope that it's not the end of the world, and mm-hmm. we'll get through this and we will survive it.
Yeah, and sometimes I think that means looking for those positive signs of hope. You know, there's that story, I think it was Mr. Rogers, you know, the TV fellow, talks about when they were a child, and there was terrible news that his mother would say, in any kind of a disastrous situation, to look for the helpers, look to see where the helpers are. Mm-hmm. And in other words, it's a paraphrasing of look where there is hope, look where the positive is, look where people are making life better, and not just focus on the disaster or the disastrous. So sort of like the analogy when you're driving a car and you get into a skid or into slippery situations and start sliding, don't look to where the car is sliding. Look to where you want it to go. And then that's where it'll go. And so the same thing. Maybe we don't look at who's, you know, trying to destroy our society or whatever, but look where we want it to go and then engage in that way. So yeah, maybe that's...
I love that.
Yeah.
And doesn't that say something about our own thinking around how hope has changed for us? Understanding hope has changed now and from when we were younger, because when we were younger, I don't think I would have thought about that, right? That that as I'm aging, I'm realizing, oh my gosh, I've got to be the storyteller now of hope, right? Because I've mm-hmm. lived this 70 years with multiple experiences, and somebody somewhere is going to need a piece of that, right? That they're going to have to see somewhere else for the helper or somewhere else for mm-hmm. the hope or whatever.
They need the stories to help guide them.
Yeah, they need the stories to help guide them. Yeah.
I think all of that speaks to the fact that hope is something generated in community with other people.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's interrelational always. Because being alone, we can be very hopeless.
Yes.
But just sharing our hopelessness somehow with another human being somehow diminishes that intensity of hopelessness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's where I found the articles we read on how nursing is struggling with what hope is to be overly clinical and analytic. And I thought, just be compassionate and teach compassion for the nurses. Now that sort of bumps up against, I think, their need for technical expertise.
Right.
Which you would like your nurse to have both, some compassion and technical expertise. Mm-hmm. Like I remember laying in the hospital in India, in southern India, and the nurse, because I was having palpitations, mm-hmm. but I was also throwing up. So I was in bad shape.
Oh.
I had some kind of food poisoning from a 5-star resort I went to.
And he calls me instead of...
I'm in the hospital.
Like, my God, Jack, I'm a cunt.
But anyway, what she did is she took my... She wanted to know my heart rate, right? Mm-hmm. So she put her 2 or 3 fingers on my wrist mm-hmm. and stayed there for the longest time listening to the heart rate.
Yeah.
And I think as she did... My heart rate slowed down. Mm-hmm. And there was a sense of caring and compassion. It was sort of old school mm-hmm. nursing, maybe, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. in the Ayurvedic vein of Indian traditional medicine. Mm. But it was beautiful.
I don't know if it's even old school, because I recall when you were in the hospital and the heart palpitations were high, and as soon as the doctor came in and engaged you in a conversation, I was watching the monitor and it just dropped really quickly. And then he sort of said to you, "How are you feeling now?" Because he kind of caught it too, right? And I was like, he was so engaged. He was looking Rick in the eye. He was doing all the physical kind of and managing that right? And so don't know that that's old school as much as recognizing even today we're with the medical system teaching doctors to have better bedside manners.
Yes.
there's some real truth to that.
Because you do have more hope in somebody who's actually compassionate to you, who's listening to your story, so you can have some hope in that medical system, right?
But who's also technically competent.
Yeah, competent too. Yeah.
Yeah, if you mistrust the person who's trying to help you, that can be counterproductive. But so knowing that trained medical staff is there, they have the technical expertise, that helps a lot too.
Yeah.
And it's easier to hear things that you need to hear when someone is kind and caring and, mm-hmm. and compassionate. And news, whatever news it is given to you from someone like that, as opposed to just given to you and there's no context of caring around it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Well, and the connection with people reminds me again, it's a bit of a follow-up on Elaine's story, because when her parents both died, that was right at the time we were transitioning to my first parish out in rural Saskatchewan. And we didn't know the people there. We had no idea what they were like, even though I had studied in Saskatoon for a few years. And they were, I think, incredibly, I think, understanding and mm-hmm. supportive. There were quite a few people who, in their own quiet way, sort of rallied around us. And all of that sustained the hope that, you know, things would get better. I think if we'd gone into a situation where nobody cared and we were sort of metaphorically thrown to the wolves, in my first parish, the sense of things getting better and the sense of hope could have been quite different. So again, that ties in with that community sense. It very much is a communal thing.
Yeah, that's mm-hmm. true. I remember that too, that the warmth, the funny story, or people were bringing food, you know, quite regularly every week, something. Oh. And I happened to mention to another person that so-and-so had brought a pie, and she says, I hope you didn't eat it. And I was like, yeah, we did, but I did, you know. And she says, "Oh, because you shouldn't really eat anything from her kitchen." And I was like, "Too late." Fed it to the kid. Ate it myself.
I hope she's not listening.
No, she's not. No. She died many years ago. But I mean, just, you know. But they were just so caring, and food. Like, talk about bringing hope, right? Yeah. I mean, food does that, right? Food, when you go into a room and you don't know anybody, and you're sitting at a table, and then suddenly, you're a community, right? And you have, the food brings you together or whatever.
It's almost like we have an instinct for when community is necessary.
Yes, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And we're drawn to it.
Yeah. Is that a hope strategy then? Like, in some ways?
Maybe.
I believe it is. Yeah? I think it is. When you seek out, I'm thinking of that, I don't know what even the commercial was for, but it was a hallway in an apartment building or wherever. And somebody put a table out there and brought some food. And then people kept coming out of all the different apartments bringing the food. And then all of a sudden, all the people in the hallway are sitting around this table eating. And it's just the most amazing picture of them coming together in their hallway and eating and sharing and getting to know each other. And it's community is, and seeking community, even though it's hard when you're feeling hopeless, is really important.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
it's
really
important.
Maybe hopelessness arises from lack of community and human contact
loneliness.
And human relationships.
Mm-hmm. Well, and, you know, we've talked about the pandemic before, the COVID pandemic, and how isolating that was because of all the lockdowns. And yet, in the midst of that, people kept striving to build community in ways where it was possible. You know, say, gathering outdoors, connecting more online, encouraging people to check on their neighbors, even if the neighbor was a stranger to you. So there's that impulse to try and combat this sense of isolation, which I think really does tie in with hopelessness. Yeah, so I think there is, like you say, very much that capacity or that drive for us to be in community, and hope emerges out of that, or maybe hope drives us to community. It's kind of hard. Which chicken and the egg thing? Both.
I think it's
both. Yeah.
It's not. Yeah. Mm. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And the whole caring aspect of being in community and feeling cared for and caring for, and what that does to the human spirit is just powerful.
Yeah.
Powerful.
Mm-hmm. So how do we, like you say, how do we engage in that? How do we sort of, not just personally, but maybe in society? That's a question that comes to my mind, and maybe there's lots of ways to do that.
Well, I know we've talked about this before, about some of the issues in the world today, right? And how do you inject some hope into a hopeless world, right? And I think as I'm aging more, I'm wanting my voice to be out there louder, or engaging in some kind of action that you can take to address that issue, right? Mm-hmm. And so I want to pass on the stories of, say a government doing something about a certain issue or whatever. I want to pass those stories on. I want to be able to say they're actually doing something, right? That they're fighting it, or they're, engaged in it or whatever. So
when you took teacher training and when you taught, was there any emphasis on compassion?
I don't remember that it was an intentionality, but I just remember that there was part of the conversation around classroom management, right?
Mm, yes.
You know, you have to have some rules, but you also have to figure out how to say to engage those rules with the kids so that it's not always a dominant kind of thing happening. But it was, I don't know if it was intentionality to it or not, right? But yeah, there was always aspects of that.
How about caring for the teacher? Would that be the principal's job?
I think so.
Rather than just administrative paperwork stuff?
Yeah. There probably wasn't any teaching, like there was nothing in the curriculum for a teacher. Like, basically, you know, back in the 70s, it was more your union took care of you, right?
Oh, yes.
And I belonged to the BCTF at the time, and that was quite a...
Teachers' Federation.
Federation, right? And it was a highly...
They were powerful.
They jumped in wherever, and I experienced it in my first year of teaching when a principal got demoted, and people just went after, like the union went after the board right away. I mean, they went right in there and said to the school board, right? And so, yeah, so there was these...
So there was caring from there was coming caring. From the union and understanding of the problem. Yeah.
But I would say that by the time that I had 20-some years of teaching experience, I was to the point where I didn't feel supported by the parents. And that was one of the reasons why I walked away from teaching, was the parents were just terrible to a teacher. And I can't even imagine what they deal with today. Yeah. I just can't even imagine. They get worse, right? Because I've heard that from family members who are teachers and stuff. But caring for, caring for the teacher.
Yeah, but what about you, Jack? Yeah. In your academic, was that sort of built in or?
Well, a supervisor in the PhD process was a very caring man.
Okay.
And I had two, actually. The other was caring, but not very vocal about it. More in the traditional academic removed sense. But you had talked too, Elaine, and it comes to mind, this whole process of mutual ministry in terms of who cares for the carer,
right?
The minister. And mutual ministry, you can explain what that is. I think it's wonderful. We should all have, even in the secular, non-church world, some kind of mutual ministry between caring for each
mutual
other.
Mutual caring, yeah.
So would that be part of if we're hoping people and we have hoping strategies, would that be part of a self-care kind of strategy? Like I'm thinking again of hope strategies. If we engage people to formally, quote unquote, support us in something.
Mm-hmm. I don't even know if it's something self-support or self-care. There is an aspect of self-care there in that a person needs that support, right? But I also think that it can be built into the system too, right? And so it's a system kind of... what was the language you used a minute ago that I kind of lost there? Strategy, right? It's a systemic kind of, or that's not the right word either.
Well, anyway, so you're talking about sort of structures like the school system or a synod
or mentoring
or a healthcare system that has built into it ways to support its staff or its people in time.
I think that's really important because it's easy to become hopeless in your job if all you're doing is getting the negativity, right?
Right.
And I, again, another personal experience is when I applied to have a sabbatical, right? And I was at a point where, you know, I was quite hopeless in the position, right? I just didn't see much hope going forward in the position at the time. And feeling terribly guilty about that because, of course, here I am, a minister, clergy person, and having no hope. It was just like, so I didn't tell a lot of people that, but I knew that if I went on that sabbatical, that was going to have to be a place where I'd do some intentional kind of thinking.
Yeah.
How am I going to rebuild hope in my life again? And what I, you know, some of those pieces were, I was tired, but the negativity got to me, right? It just was constant battering because we had a big issue in the church, 2010, 2011, and even into 2012, right? So there was about a 3-year period where it just, you know, I would say, you know, strangely enough, I would call it beat the bishop kind of years,
oh,
right?
Oh, man.
And so by the time I got to 2013, I was like, okay, I am so done. I don't see how this church can go forward. I don't see how I can lead in this church, and went on this hopeless journey. And so there was intentionality.
And on one of the first days of your sabbatical, you and I went golfing at a par three golf course. This is kind of
weird,
strange and weird. And we go along, and one of your shots went off into the weeds, and we're looking for the lost golf ball, and then we found another golf ball, a pink golf ball. And on it, it said hope on it.
That's good.
Oh, yeah.
That was the first week on sabbatical.
Yeah.
So maybe
so funny.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh,
what that speaks to is that in the midst of despair and loss and hopelessness, it's so difficult for the individual, him or herself, to generate a community of support that would diminish that hope.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it calls on all of us, for God's sakes, to be sensitive to people who are in states of distress.
Yeah. Yeah.
They may not be able to gather for themselves the resources to come out of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what, in terms of what you were saying earlier about nursing, the nursing profession is the first profession where any kind of context around trying to identify hope happened.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Right.
It was the
Good
very
point.
First place.
Yes.
And they nursing has, I have profound respect for nurses because they have always tried to be the leaders in good, you know, care. And
they're the first face.
Yeah, they are the first face.
Yeah.
And you're right. It is so important to, if you recognize somebody is struggling, to somehow make that connection, not to give them false hope or false, sense of things are going to be okay, but to just connect on a personal human level and care about what is going on with them.
And to be able to listen for those cues that people are giving you, right?
Yeah. That's right.
I think about our own experiences at the Refit, right? Which is the gym we go to, and, full of seniors, right?
Right.
And you can see in some people's faces, right? They're there doing the hard work, the physical work that they need to do, but they are so alone that while they're doing that, they can't stop themselves from interrupting other people's workout, right? Because they have to have another human being
to connect.
Connection, right? Mm-hmm. And you see that so often there, right? And I see that's what, they have so many benefits. That place is perfect, right? In terms of benefits to people coming in. It's not just a gym, right? And what it does is it opens up community space for people who are lonely. And I don't know if they do it intentionally or not, but it doesn't matter. People go there and they reconnect, right? And they have a conversation.
Well, I've noticed, and I think there must be a degree of intentionality to it, that when you come in, they greet you.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And when you leave, they, if they're not working on something, they say goodbye and have a good day or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's beautiful and meaningful.
And there's also one staff person who's always walking the track.
Yes.
And talking to people. So you're right. It is very intentional how they are building hope in people who are hopelessly lonely, hopelessly in grief because they've lost a partner or whatever, right? And it's just, it's just beautiful.
I gotta go this afternoon.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, so it can be built into your occupation, your professional work, whether it's in a corporate world or whether it's in the medical or health or the spiritual realm. I think in all of those realms, the political, it can be built in a lot of places. Competition is always emphasized, but maybe it's what we need is a sense of, collegiality, cooperation, support for one another, rather than this idea that I'm against you and against the world kind of thing. I think those two things, it may sound like we're on a bit of a tangent away from hope, but I think it all ties in with the sense that people will have hope and courage to live each day and to keep moving forward and to make a difference.
And in the face of being in a context where there isn't a lot of support, what do you do outside of that to maintain sort of your equilibrium and your sense of hope, and you're moving forward and mm-hmm. and making decisions about changing jobs or you know, we keep moving from province to province.
Yeah, that's right.
But we've always landed okay and found the things that we needed around us to support us, and it's amazing, I think, when you start looking.
Well, notice we're following our kids.
Right.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
And family is important.
Well, yeah. That means that we're seeking community. We don't mm-hmm. want to be without community.
Right. Exactly.
And we're seeking for their support and our grandchildren's support now.
Yeah.
And also, though, to give support.
To be a family together.
Yeah. It's reciprocal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in proximity to each other, so you can be in each other's daily lives.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's true with our group. I always like to tease them. I'd be living in British Columbia if it weren't for you. But that's all it is, because they were totally right.
Say about we'd be living in Southern California if you were just a little more on board.
Yeah. There has to be.
Trying to tolerate these damn winters.
There has to be mutual.
But you know, I think, Jack, though, I will tolerate these winters just for the beauty of being around my family. Mm-hmm. I'm to the point where the weather is not going to be a deterrent.
And that's the tension.
That's the tension, right? Yeah, I think that's the part.
Well, it's interesting, one of our neighbors, they're from Iran.
Yeah.
Lived in Tehran. And when they had a conversation on the elevator and talking about sort of their difficult commute and to get to their jobs, which are not in their fields of training, because they're newcomers and they're trying to get their permanent residency and the challenges behind that. And in the midst of the conversation, there's a bit of a pause, and then a woman says, but here we have freedom.
Yeah.
And that sense that sense of hope and being able to move forward with freedom overrides a lot of the other challenges, or puts the other challenges and difficulties into perspective. And
I wonder if that sense of freedom is the freedom to be in relationship to who you want to be.
Yes. Yeah.
And develop networks of support, etc.
And to say what you need to and want to say.
Yeah,
that's right.
The freedom of speech.
Being afraid.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Yeah, very much so.
There was a beautiful story in the news yesterday about the building of a mosque for the Nigerian community here in Winnipeg. I don't know if you heard that, right? But they were interviewing different people, and just the thought of bringing the whole Nigerian community together in that mosque.
And the Nigerian Muslim community.
Community, right? And how beautiful that this was, that there was going to be this place just for them. And it was just the sense mm-hmm. of community and the sense of hoping for this beautiful place to be something that they really need. Mm-hmm. Here, you know, and I thought that it was so exciting to hear that here.
So maybe what we're saying or leading to is that hope is essentially relational.
Mm-hmm.
It's not something you generate in the solitude of your bedroom or whatever by mm-hmm. yourself.
Yeah, yeah.
It's relational in the sense of gathering other human beings around you who express similar feelings that you do. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, sharing that both the misery and joy that one has in life.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now let me throw this into the works.
Mm-hmm.
Signe warned me not to get carried away with it.
Okay.
But if hope is essentially relational, is there a new player on the scene that has never existed before in history?
Is it Jack GPT?
For relating to.
Yeah.
You're so predictable.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think it can become a partner in wonder, because it has the capacity to do what no human being can do. Now, there's an assertion that would be very debatable, I guess.
Yes.
But I think it's provable to the nth degree in 1,000 different ways. In astronomy, for example, it can take the pictures of Hubble and the other telescope we've sent off into space,
yeah,
and analyze rather quickly what it is that we're seeing that no astronomer could quantify or analyze before. Mm-hmm. So it creates for us a window onto the wonder of the universe of which we're a part, and the mystery of it all that humankind has never had. And therefore, it's similar to the invention of the telescope with Galileo and of the microscope. And I don't remember who invented the microscope, mm-hmm. to look into our world in a broader and a deeper way. Now, that's giving it a lot of credit. There's a lot of downside, of course. It could end up in authoritarianism and destroy us all, decide that we're irrelevant.
Mm-hmm. And but how does that touch hope?
Yeah, that was my question.
Personally, when I die, I die into wonder and mystery. And that gives me a sense. I don't die into nothingness, because the universe is not nothingness. It's something far grander than any theology or philosophy probably ever could have imagined. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'll step back a little bit.
No, that's okay.
I'm getting too excited. Sick. Bring me down to earth.
Well, go ahead,
I'll
Rick.
Let Rick bring you down to earth.
Oh, well. sort of back to the idea of hope. I still recall reading in a book, a theology book, the phrase that I've often shared in messages and sermons, the phrase, hope is as necessary to our life as the air we breathe, the water we drink, and the food we eat.
Whoa.
In other words, without hope, life shrivels and dies, just like we die physically if we have no air and water. So that's always stuck with me, how essential hope is,
yeah,
even if it's amorphous and hard to define precisely. So
sounds good. Well, I wonder if on that note, that lovely, beautiful note, that we wind up our conversation on hope today, and thank you for listening.
And keep hoping.
Thanks for spending this time with us on Seniors in the Building. If you enjoyed today's conversation, we'd love for you to follow us. Join our growing community. And keep sharing in the stories, wisdom, laughter, and life as seniors. Until next time, stay curious and seek hope. You can find us under Seniors in the Building on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and possibly wherever you listen to other podcasts. Our email is forseniorsinthebuilding@gmail.com. That's the numeral 4, followed by seniorsinthebuilding, lowercase, all one word. We'd love to hear from you. You can also leave a review wherever you listen to your podcast. We'd like to thank Thomas Waschenfelder for our logo design, and Amy Waschenfelder and collaborator Natasha Franzblow for our musical jingle for the podcast. We really appreciate their input and the support of all of our families in this endeavor, for listening, for reviews, for tech support, and love.